Levi's head bobbed happily, his eyes alight.
Ah, but which truth?
The truth of God. What other kind is there?
To be sure, my young friend, but how well do we discern the truth? For example, in the biblical account, Ararat clearly refers to a mountain range. In all probability, it has nothing to do with the giant cinder cone which currently bears that name.
Aren't there, like, two different accounts of the whole Ark thing in the Old Testament anyway? I seem to remember from my Sunday school classes that one says there was one pair of each kind of animal, and then there's like another that says there were seven types of some animals and only pairs of others.
That was what Anya remembered as well. She felt it better to stay out of this. Sure, her sympathies lay with her fellow Chasing History's Monsters staff from New York, but she was acutely aware of being stuck in the middle here. Taking sides wouldn't help things go smoothly, and the worst risks and hardships still lay ahead. She knew how tensions could build up to the point of erupting in unreasonable outbursts of anger on the most conventional expedition. This one was anything but.
But that's easy. If there's seven of some kinds of animals, there's at least a pair of them, right? So there isn't any contradiction.
Both Jason and Trish sat up straighter, ready to hit that like a bass spotting a juicy worm. Levi spoke before they could, obliviously. Or maybe not, Anya wondered.
If only things were so simple. There are other explanations, too, after all. The Babylonian account claims the gods determined to flood the whole world basically because humans made too much noise and it bothered them. In that version, the Ark Builder is named Unapishtim. He was a friend of Gilgamesh, epic fame.
Wasn't he the dude that won immortality?
Well, the standard accounts claim that Gilgamesh tried and failed, but certain tablets claim he made it. Then again, there's a flood account in the apocryphal First Book of Enoch, apparently dating to the 2nd century BCE, as you secular archaeologists like to term it, which claims it was intended to wipe out the Nephilim, a race of evil giants begotten by angels on the daughters of men.
That's different.
Must have worked. Seen any giants lately?
Well, of course the giants were among those who failed to survive the flood, like dinosaurs.
The three television crew members stared at him.
Dinosaurs?
Of course. Dinosaurs and humans lived together before the flood. That's why there are dinosaurs in the fossil record.
What kind of crazy insane is that?
Anya saw the hackles rise on the young wolves.
Hey, enough.
That silenced the three for a moment.
Look, I still have trouble with this whole thing. Are you people seriously saying a flood plopped this ship down 15,500 feet above sea level? That's like 3 miles. Where'd all the water come from? Where'd it all go?
Why, the same place it came from. By the will of God, the waters fell from the sky. By the will of God, they returned to the sky. It was a miracle.
But if God could do that, why bother with a flood in the first place? Why not flick all the sinful stuff off the earth at once like boogers?
Some of the others grimaced at that, but Larry shook his head with a smile.
The ways of God are not the ways of man.
Anya held up her hands.
Wait now. I don't think we're all going to agree on things here. So can we just agree to disagree?
Are you gonna let them get away with mocking the word of God, Larry?
Turn the other cheek, Zack. That's what Charlie would say to do.
The invocation of the holy name, Charlie Bostitches, quieted the others right down. Anya wondered if Rehoboam Academy students and graduates weren't encouraged to snitch on each other over signs of dissent or heresy.
We have to work together. We have a tough road ahead, maybe even before we get to the mountain. And once we do, we've got a tough climb ahead of us. So let's all just step back, take deep breaths, and save our energy, because we're going to need every bit of it later.
Slowly, Wilfork clapped his hands.
Ah, bravo, Miss Cree, bravo. When controversy rears its ugly head, dodge the issue. Intellectual cowardice to the rescue.
Cheeks burning, Anya wheeled on him.
Oh, Mr. Wilfork, these arguments have been going on now for thousands of years. Do you think they're going to be settled this afternoon, here on this bus?
They passed the night in what Leif Baron called a safe house in Erzurum. It didn't look much like a house to Anya, nor strike her as especially safe, as flashlights held by her companions swept across and around it in the early evening gloom. It was a rambling, ramshackle block of structures rising as high as 3 scary-leaning stories, thrown together of cinder blocks, bricks, wood, sheet metal, plywood, what seemed to be fieldstone, and God knew what else. Random segments were painted a grim mustard yellow. The whole thing was cheerless enough to be a prison, an effect heightened by its being surrounded by high chain-link fences topped with coils of razor wire.
The GC can do.
Will Fork spoke with his usual assurance as they dismounted from the school bus, blinking in the unexpected brightness of afternoon sun shining through big breaks in the clouds, and staring in consternation at their quarters for the night.
It means built overnight. There's a loophole in the Turkish law that forbids civic authorities from tearing down unauthorized structures if they are entirely built with between sundown and sunup.
Just the kind of place where I want to spend the night.
Trish carried her pack on her shoulder and wore a green ball cap on her head.
Might be worse. Might be raining.
Anya looked reflexively upward. A few brave stars greeted her eyes. Only a few brushstrokes of cloud were visible. Rain did not seem to be in the offing, nor, thankfully, did more snow. The air was cool, redolent of petroleum and what she suspected was a nearby stockyard, but not cold. She thought again about conditions on Ararat with the early onset of winter weather and shivered anyway. The Gisikandu lay not far from the Euphrates, which the ragtag caravan crossed at dusk. Levi said the headwaters weren't far from here. This was an industrial part of town near another rail yard and seemed mostly derelict at that. Certainly there were no other residential-looking structures in the area. The young wolves set up portable generators to power lights inside. There was no electrical supply. Inside, the walls were bare, and whatever plumbing and wiring existed had long since been ripped out by metal thieves or scavengers. There were pallets on the floors, but they bore an off-putting smell of decay. The newcomers inflated air mattresses, with which they were thankfully well supplied, and unrolled sleeping bags on them. While this was going on, along with a certain amount of sweeping and waving things in the air in hopes of stirring it and cutting into the mustiness, and much grumbling, Larry and the Higgins twins were sent off in the lead car with Mr. Atabeg to forage for provisions.
How come we have to skulk into this hole in the middle of a post-apocalypse urban nightmare number 3, and then the Bible Scouts get sent off on their own without adult supervision?
Jason's question, fortunately, sounded out of earshot of the remaining young wolves. Baron and Bostich repaired with Wilfork and the rabbi to quarters on an upper story, presumably more sumptuous than what the ground floor offered, if you set aside the risk the floor might collapse under you. But, it occurred to Anya, if that happened, the floor would collapse on them. So it was probably kind of a wash.
I think they want to get them experience on their own in potentially hostile territory. Then again, they didn't tell me.
What if they, like, screw up and bring whoever it is we're supposed to be hiding out from here down on top of our heads?
Tommy was disgruntled because Bostich forbade them to take video of their current surroundings.
My guess? That's good for at least 3 demerits each.
After a short while, Wilfork came down to step outside for a smoke. Anya happened to be outdoors in her shirt sleeves doing stretches to work out the day's kinks. Wilfork noticed her and turned away, as if hoping somehow that if he couldn't see her, she wouldn't see him. Anya marched across the gravel compound to him.
Hey, Wilfork!
He turned around.
Anya, I didn't...
Save it. I want to know what was up with your sharpshooting me on the bus today about trying to cut short potential conflict. Did I step on your shadow or something?
For some reason, he seemed to go a shade paler at that.
Be careful what you say.
Look, I'm not okay with what you said. I'm trying to prevent bloodshed on this expedition, at least among its own members.
Surely you're over-dramatizing.
You think so? Really? We've got a bunch of militant and, in fact, trained paramilitary and even military types who are fervent right-wing Christian fundamentalists. Then we've got a contingent of equally militant lefty atheists, or at least scoffers, from Babylon itself, New York City. Throw in the sort of stresses you get even on a regular expedition, one where you're not actually on the run from the authorities, you know? And where your official contact doesn't explode in flames right in front of your eyes? And you've got a high explosive mix with the stability of a speed freak at the wrong end of a 3-week binge. What the hell were you thinking?
Wilfork shook his head.
Really, I am sorry. I just have an impish impulse to stir things up.
So you can report on it when it all blows? Are you that hard up for a story?
Well, hard up may not be too far off the mark.
What do you mean?
This crisis journalism may not be a young man's game. Somehow I don't find it as easy as I once did. And I find it my misfortune to grow old in a world that values youth over experience. And the bottom line above all. It's easy to look at a seasoned journalist and see someone doing a job you could hire a fresh-faced journalism graduate and do for half the money.
That's your excuse?
Very well. I confess it bothered me that you seem to be successful in calming the waters. Lack of controversy makes a lack of interest in my chronicle, and then where's my bestseller?
So you're looking to hit one big score and then retire? That sounds like something from a caper movie.
Well, thank you for so perceptively comparing me to a professional criminal.
Sorry, I'm still a little hot over this. You, of all people, should know how nasty this could all get in a big hurry, given all that crisis experience you talk about. Don't imagine that journalistic detachment is going to keep it from getting all over you if it does blow up. And by the way, my crew from New York are here as journalists too, aren't they?
By a definition shockingly liberal even by my standards.
Which may say more or maybe less for your own prejudices than anything else. But think about this. If things really start to fly, do you think your status as direct employee of Charlie Bostich will shield you? A reformed commie and alcoholic is not the sort of person the religiously enthusiastic are going to give too much slack to. Unless you out and out convert to their brand of muscular Christianity, which I doubt you have.
Not really, aren't you? Well, I'm sorry. I meant it as a joke. I see now that it was inappropriate, as the current phrase goes. I'll try not to do it again.
Wilfork screwed his big pink face up in what was at least a good imitation of contrition.
I have to confess there's more at stake here than my final payday and its contribution to my retirement fund, which, yes, I must admit, does enter into my calculations. I still find myself drawn to the excitement. Sheer adventure. My age and outward appearance notwithstanding.
So kicks just keep getting harder to find.
Anya regretted it the moment it left her mouth. She didn't mean to sound so witchy. She never intended to. And she didn't want to participate anymore in any kind of potentially destructive melodramas. But instead of taking offense, Wilfork nodded enthusiastically.
Precisely. I fear that along with my numerous other addictions, under better or worse control, as they may be, I'm also what's currently called an adrenaline junkie. But I promise to try and restrict my fixes to what our enterprise provides in the natural course of things, rather than trying to generate my own.
Good, because if I catch you causing actual danger to my people or me, I'll totally kick your ass. No brag, just fact.
You know, I believe you could at that.
Let him find out for himself if he really wants to so badly.
Anya forced herself to cool down.
Don't start pouring gasoline on the fire you're trying to put out.
Miss Creed, I bid you a good evening.
You too.
An hour later, the foraging party came back bearing cardboard cartons filled with Turkish takeaway. They ate by the garish light of generator-powered trouble lamps on folding tables set up in a one-story segment on one end of the Gisi Kandu that seemed to have served as a garage. The smells of old accumulated grease and oil were far more appetizing than what pervaded the rest of the structure. The food was good, washed down with some kind of Turkish fruit drink and the inevitable bottled water. Anya fended off several invitations from Bostich to share the upper floor accommodations. He seemed still elated at their action movie escape from the hotel in Ankara, with spots of color glowing high upon his cheeks. Anya wondered if he might have fallen off the wagon again. His manner was jovially avuncular. It wasn't far from that to creepy uncle, though, and Anya was pleased when he didn't press the issue too hard. Anya's team and the young wolves headed for separate but adjoining compartments.
And keep in mind, no lewd cohabitation.
It sounded to Anya as if Josh was trying a joke.
Hey now, I just had my heart set on Lud cohabitating. Just couldn't wait to get right on down to it.
Josh blinked. He seemed more puzzled and a little hurt than offended. Predictably, Zack and a couple of the others scowled, though, and seemed set to start woofing back.
Jason, stop being a dick.
Jason jerked around and shut his mouth. It surprised Anya to hear the young woman speak up like that to one of her comrades. Anya had been thinking much the same thing. She felt constrained, mostly because it wasn't her style to call somebody a dick, though mincing words wasn't her style either. With no further static, the groups went their ways. Anya likewise refused an offer from the three CHM staffers to join them, huddled in a corner of the room they staked out as their own, to share a pint of whiskey thoughtfully donated by Wilfork. They muttered about the way Leif Baron told the young wolves to patrol the perimeter by two-hour watches, a pair at a time. They speculated, in tones half scandalized and half fearful, whether the sentinels were actually armed. For her part, Anya hoped they were. And she was glad there were guards. That was something she could say for Baron. She doubted anyone would slack off on his watch. She actually felt secure enough to sleep the whole night through, and no compunction about doing so. Watch standing wasn't her job. The next day found everybody semi-rested and grumpy. Not even Anya could muster much enthusiasm for a breakfast of cold rice, ground lamb and pine nuts, wrapped in grape leaves and washed down with acrid grape soda. In a few hours, the battered bus was jouncing and clattering down what was nominally a paved two-lane road through broken terrain, beneath an overcast sky that suggested their respite from snow was ending. Levi held forth among the group of young wolves.
Ari province once was part of the ancient kingdom of Urartu.
The Rehoboam Academy alums never seemed to know quite how to treat the rabbi. They listened attentively, with eyes wide, as if on the one hand not wanting to miss a drop of the wisdom he was imparting, and on the other, fearing he'd at any moment start trying to seduce them into worshipping pagan idols.
Urartu is the source of the name Ararat.
Yeah, might as well be mud, lads.
Wilfork sat in the seat in front of Levi.
Someone blew up a Turkish-Iranian natural gas pipeline hereabouts in August of 2006. Since then, fighting between Kurd separatists and the Turkish army has escalated into open but unpublicized warfare.
Good news is everywhere.
Anya's cell phone rang. Everyone turned and stared at her. Feeling conspicuous, she took it out and flipped it open.
Hello?
Creed, this is Baron. Look alive, we might have a situation here.
At the same time, Tommy Wynock pointed out the front window.
Whoa! Roadblock. Again?
No worries. Mr. Atabeg will wave his hand and make it all okay.
With much shuddering and squeaking of brakes, the bus slowed to a stop. Their forward passage was barred by a stake-bed truck parked across the road.
Maybe not.
Tall men in dark caps and long black coats stepped out into the road in front of the block, pointing Kalashnikovs at the lead car.
These guys don't look all that amenable to sweet reason.
Tell everybody to stay calm back there. Atabeg says he's on top of it.
He hung up.
Baron says Atabeg's on top of it.
Anya had to admit Atabeg had proven effective so far. Twice since leaving their miserable hideout in Erzurum, they'd been stopped by army checkpoints, and once pulled over by a National Army motorized patrol. Each time, Mr. Atabeg dealt with it with his trademark blend of cheeriness, gesticulation, and, she suspected strongly, a good strong dose of bribery. But this roadblock was a different thing entirely. Anya hoped this bunch proved as acquisitive as the National Police. Tommy hauled his black camera bag down from the overhead wire mesh rack and started to zip it open.
Hey, what are you doing?
Gotta get some shots of this, man.
Not a good idea, man.
Fairley's handsome young face was pale. The lead car had stopped. Baron and Atabeg climbed out into the road and walked toward the men at the roadblock. A moment later, Bostich emerged and Larry Tate from behind the wheel.
Josh is right, Tommy.
But this is some great shit. It'll make for wicked awesome TV.
Think of how much more gripping the viewers back home will find it when you videotape your own massacre at the hands of peevish tribals with medieval attitudes and thoroughly modern weapons.
They have guns? I hate guns.
Me too.
Anya looked at them in surprise. She thought they were a fairly seasoned crew. Apparently, they either had only visited the tamer parts of the world on their shoots for Chasing History's Monsters, or Doug sprang for a better quality of local fixers to insulate them from the harsher local realities than Anya would have given him credit. Whether you liked guns or not was beside the point. In most of America, especially the sanitized, if not quite so safe as advertised, New York City, somebody sporting fully automatic weapons was cause to alert the media. In much of the Third World, it was part of the scenery. Anya had no trouble with guns, per se. What she had trouble with was people pointing them at her, which, unfortunately, seemed a form of trouble that was just about to recur. Josh got out of his seat to lean over and look out a window.
Those aren't the Turkish National Police.
Not Army, either.
Fred Mallory, the dark-haired bodybuilder, seldom said much, like the carrot-topped Eli, who sat across the aisle from him. Both seemed content to let others do the talking, and probably the thinking. The men at the block weren't uniformed as such. They wore long sheepskin coats over long smock-like wool shirts and baggy trousers, the basic dress of South Asia from Iraq to Pakistan. Some wore black wool hats, others knit caps. The tall man who seemed to be in charge, whose splendid beard and piercing eyes made him resemble a younger Osama bin Laden, sported a flat cap and a 1911 series Colt 45, or reasonable facsimile thereof, stuffed down the front of his gray camouflage trousers. The hammer was back, Anya could see. It didn't mean the safety was on. In fact, the odds were good it wasn't. He stood with thumbs tucked on either side of the big, angular handgun, listening as Atabeg expostulated at him. Or so Anya guessed from the way the short, dumpy Turk, dapper as ever in his utterly inappropriate suit, waved his arms and hopped around.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have the pleasure of presenting to you the Kurds.
Great.
Anya couldn't tell if that was irony or not.
And we can't even shoot stills?
That verb, to shoot, that's kind of key here. It's the sort of idea we don't want people getting.
Are they Peshmerga?
I'd rather say so, given the Kalashnikovs and beards.
Trish was so anxious she neglected to bridle at being called dear.
In Kurdish, the name Peshmerga means those who face death.
That's encouraging.
Anya's cell rang again.
I thought you were tight with these guys.
There are Peshmerga, and then there are Peshmerga. These aren't my guys.
What do you want us to do?
Sit tight and stay frosty. I told you, Atabeg's got us covered.
Right about then, the Peshmerga leader pulled the 45 out of his pants and shot Atabeg point blank. The muzzle was about a handspan from the stick pin of the smaller man's necktie.
Shit!
Baron grabbed Charlie and threw him bodily into the ditch by the roadside. He flung himself on top of his boss. Atabeg staggered back. A dark stain spread across the front of his shirt, and his necktie was burning with a smoky blue flame. The Peshmerga leader shot him again, and he fell on his back with arms flung out. The fez came off his head and rolled a few feet away, revealing the bald spot on the top of his head. As the other Peshmerga raised their Kalashnikovs and began to lash the ditch where Baron threw Bostich with bullets, the bus door slammed inward. From outside came a gust of new falling snow, a knife-edged chill. The bus driver leapt from his seat, dashed out the door, ran off up the side of a hill, and was swallowed from sight as the blizzard outside intensified.
Cowardly heathen.
Anya sympathized with the driver. He hadn't signed on for this. He sure wasn't getting paid enough. An immense-looking, broken-nosed AKM assault rifle came in the door, seeming to tow a tall man in a cap behind. He swept the bus with dark eyes and the muzzle brake of his rifle. He favored Anya with a gap-toothed leer and then started toward the back of the bus, evidently intent on securing the men, the only opponents he considered worthy of notice. Eyes blazing, Anya watched him. As he came abreast of her, she lunged at him in a tigerish leap. She caught the gunman totally unaware. Her sudden onslaught sent him staggering several steps backward, slamming his head into the steel pole behind the driver's seat. At the same time, she grabbed the forestock of his weapon, controlling it, driving the barrel up. He triggered a burst. She was totally intent on her target as a burst ripped through the ceiling over Wilfork's head. The journalist vanished to the floor. It was an old-school Soviet-era rifle, and it packed quite a kick. The full-auto recoil jarred the weapon loose in the stunned man's grip. Anya wrenched it away, then butt-stroked him in his bearded face. He fell to the floor, holding up an arm to defend himself. It didn't help. Gritting her teeth in rage, Anya smashed the metal butt plate into his face and the side of his head, battering him into the slushy, gritty rubber runner that covered the steel floorboards. She stopped. Slowly, she straightened. The gunman lay unmoving at her feet. Blood totally obscured his face. The bus was silent as a tomb. The firefight outside sounded like fireworks from a distant stadium.
That ought to hold him.
She was aware that all of them, the CHM crew, young wolves, even hardened, troubled journalist Wolfork, were staring at her as if she'd just turned into a pterodactyl.
Watch him anyway, in case it doesn't.
Jason raised an ashen, trembling face to her.
Anya, what are you doing?
What needs to be done. Keep your heads down.
She was out the open door into the snow. The Kalashnikov was a familiar, comforting weight in her arms.
I'm glad I could take care of that one without the sword coming out.
She barely felt the bite of the air. The snowflakes hit her face like tiny wet slaps. Anya followed the driver's path up the ridge toward a clump of rocks already thoroughly mounded over in white. If she was going to do any good, if she was going to do anything other than catch around and go down, she had to get to cover fast. Fortunately, the gunman on the bus flew solo to his crash landing with Anya. Apparently, the Peshmerga felt one bus full of foreign infidels only required one fighter. The others, maybe a half dozen or so, including the leader, still stood blasting happily away at the defenders in the ditch. The Americans were shooting back gamely, but it was handguns against assault rifles. It was not as hopeless as it might seem at that closer range. A burst from a Kalashnikov wasn't going to kill you any deader than a good handgun hit to chest or head, and presumably the Americans were bothering to aim. That was more than the Kurds were doing. They were ducking down behind rocks or the vehicles to reload, then standing bolt upright to blaze off their whole magazine in the general direction of the foe. Still, only Leif Baron and Larry Tate, who had joined his boss and bodyguard in the ditch, could return fire. Presumably, one or the other was sitting on Charlie Bostich's head to keep it down. Their worst problem was that they could seldom get a shot of their own off for the torrent of bullets streaming their way. It was one of the relatively few circumstances where handheld full-auto fire really did provide an advantage. The superior, if unaimed, Kurd firepower kept the American pair all but suppressed.
We're about to change that, you rat bastards.
Using the big metal lever on the side of the stamped steel receiver, she switched her weapon from full auto to single shot with the famous loud Kalashnikov clack.
Damn.
No one noticed. The noise levels were too high. And anyway, as she knew too well, when somebody was shooting at you directly, your whole world tended to narrow to the pinpoint focus on that person and his gun. Even a highly trained and seasoned special warrior like Baron would be able to spare little perception for anything but the firing enemies. Anya snugged the rifle's steel butt plate against her shoulder. Hard early lessons with a Kalashnikov taught her respect for the gun and to keep her cheek off the buttstock. To the side of her field of vision, Anya saw one Kurd fall back, downed by bullets from one of her companions. Almost directly in front of her, though, was a cagier fighter, better trained or better seasoned. He knelt behind a rock with the buttstock held to his shoulder and pulled off short bursts, instead of hosing the landscape a magazine at a time. Clearly, he was the most dangerous opponent. Aside from the fact he was more likely to hit one of her friends, he was also hard for one of them to hit, since he actually used cover. She lined up the black-capped head between the ears of the rear sights and the hooded post of the front sight. Anya squeezed the trigger. The rifle kicked Anya's shoulder hard. She let the weapon ride up in recoil, then brought it down with proper follow-through. Then she moved to another target. Even before the rising barrel had obscured her vision, she'd seen the shooter's head jerk and a cloud puff out beyond it, dark in the dull afternoon light. None of the other half-dozen standing enemies noticed the fall of the marksman behind the rock. She put down two more with solid hits to the torso before the survivors broke and ran, realizing with a sudden adrenal fear jolt that someone was firing at them from the flank. Abandoning their own vehicle, they rabbited off over the nearby hills. Baron and Larry Tate swarmed out of the ditch, grabbed up fallen Kalashnikovs, and fired after them with quick shoulder-aimed bursts. One threw up his arms, his rifle soaring up over his head theatrically, before collapsing over the top of a ridge out of sight. A velvet curtain silence descended. Anya slumped to the cold ground. She let herself just lay there and quiver with reaction for 3 whole breaths. Then she stood and walked back toward the bus, brushing snow off the front of her jacket and pants with one hand. She held the Kalashnikov ready in the other. She doubted the Kurds would stop running for some time, as they'd taken terrible casualties in terms of their small numbers. But she wasn't going to better life on that.
Nice job, Creed!
Baron rose out of the ditch, followed with obvious effort by Charlie Bostitch. He brushed snow-damp bits of dead vegetation from his trench coat as he lumbered quickly toward her.
Anya! Thank the Lord you're all right!
Before she could elude or try to dissuade him, he caught her in an enfolding embrace. Fortunately, it was no more than a sort of clumsy dancing bear hug. If he harbored any impure ideas beyond that, they didn't come through. Of course, that might have been tricky, given that he'd trapped the heavy Russian rifle crosswise between their bodies. Releasing her, he held her out to arm's length for a moment. Out of politeness, she didn't try to squirm away. Still wired from the fight, she was determined that if he got out of line, she'd give him a fast knee where it would do the most good, boss or no boss.
You've done a remarkable thing. But why didn't you let the men handle it?
In light of whom she agreed to work with, she'd already performed the necessary attitudinal self-adjustments not to give in to reflex resentment at a question like that. Besides, she had to admit it wouldn't take a dyed-in-the-wool male chauvinist to ask it. In her place, most women would have said the same thing. And most women would probably have been right, too.
He had the drop on the men, sir. The man on the bus did, I mean. He was also pretty focused on them. I saw my opening and acted. And then because I knew what to do next, I went ahead and did it.
That's a pretty concise after-action report.
They took stock of the situation. Mr. Atabeg was dead. So were 6 of the roadblock party. If any of the Kurds got injured, their companions carried them off with them. And though Bostitch, Baron, and Tate were soggy, dirty, and chilled through from diving into a ditch partially filled with snow, none of them was hurt. Neither was anybody on the bus. There was no sign of the bus driver. The CHM crew and several of Bostitch's pack wandered around the ridges looking for him to no avail. The worst news was that neither the lead car nor the school bus was going anywhere anytime soon. The shine was off the Mercedes SUV, with bullet holes speckling what looked like every square inch of its bodywork and the starred and sagging windows. Meanwhile, the engine compartment of the battered white school bus got shot up. The radiator was gone, the engine block probably cracked. Or so Baron Tommy and a couple of the young wolves, who knew a lot more about cars than Anya did, said after prying up the damaged hood. However, all the full-auto high-power rounds had gone one way. Aside from a hole in the windshield, the truck blocking the road was intact. It started immediately when Baron tried it. Unfortunately, the stake bed was too small to accommodate both the luggage and the passengers from the deceased bus. The pickup that brought up the rear was untouched, although its driver likewise departed for parts unknown at some time during the proceedings. It was already overloaded with the expedition's equipment.
Well, good news is, we're getting into the area where I have contacts.
Yeah, contacts with the Kurds have been highly gratifying so far.
Everyone ignored Wilfork, although Anya admitted to herself his point. Taking Josh Fairley with him, Baron motored off down the road in the truck in search of more transport. Charlie Bostitch and Robin Wilfork clambered back on the dead bus and sat sharing a seat with their heads together, while Larry Tate enthusiastically oversaw the unloading of the gear from the back. Anya went off to the side and sat with Rabbi Leibowitz and watched.
Should we help?
Under most circumstances, I would, but I think we probably need to preserve our standing as expert consultants, not grunt laborers. Besides, it'll do the young wolves good to work off some of that adrenaline.
Young wolves?
Sorry. Private nickname I gave them. It wasn't supposed to come out.
They do seem lupine somehow.
Levi watched the Rehoboam Academy contingent joke and hoot as they hauled out the baggage.
They show distinct pack behavior, I believe. Very appropriate name, Anya.
Thanks. So, how are you holding up?
Me? I'm fine. Why?
Well, I mean, being caught in the middle of a firefight and all.
I leave handling that sort of thing to others. As for the danger, I'm a student of the Cabal. Not in the sense that's received all the publicity the last few years.
I understand the distinction. I've run into several flavors of Cabalist the last few years. All of whom spell it differently.
Well, the Semitic tongues don't fit in the Latin transliteration very well, I'm afraid. In any event, I suppose I have a philosophical attitude towards such matters. Perhaps it's merely being an otherworldly scholar.
Anya felt a rush of warmth for this strange, genial man.
Don't worry, Levi. Wait, I guess you don't. Keep on not worrying. I'll get you up the mountain and down safely, whether I make it or not.
She thought Levi might be caught out by her declaration. Imagine it was bravado coming from a mere woman. Instead, he smiled.
Well, of course, Anya. I knew you would. It's what you do. Protect the innocent.
The Chasing History's Monsters team came down the ridge carrying their gear. Once the shooting stopped, they bailed out to record as much as they could of what happened.
Thank goodness they couldn't catch any video of me shooting.
They looked oddly deflated. They seemed to be studiously ignoring Zeb, who'd accompanied them to the crest line with a Kalashnikov recovered from one of the dead gunmen hung around his neck on a waist-length Israeli-style sling. Anya thought it a good idea. There was no telling whether the Kurds might decide to come back with reinforcements to avenge their fallen comrades. She wasn't sure whether the trio from New York were in deep denial over the danger or just uncomfortable around an armed man. She got a quick hint as they came up to her. All three stared at her as if she'd turned into a scorpion.
I feel like I don't know you. I feel like I don't know if I want to know you.
Yeah.
Tommy still had his big camera perched on his shoulder.
That whole thing totally creeped me out. That dude is dead, Anya. You smashed in the whole side of his head.
Her relief over the attacker's death scarcely penetrated her surprised hurt at the reception she was getting from her compatriots. She steeled herself to take whatever her fundamentalist employers from the other side of the culture wars chose to dish out, but the raw fear, loathing, and sheer rejection from what she thought of as her own people felt like an ice-cold bucket of betrayal thrown in her face.
But why are you angry with her? She saved your lives. She saved all our lives.
She should have let the authorities handle it.
Authorities?
Violence never solves anything, dude.
Violence would seem to have settled that gunman on the bus, yes?
Now that is one sorry-ass motorcade.
Jason peered up the road at the approaching procession of vehicles. 2 hours passed before Baron called Bostitch to let him know he and Fairley were inbound with new transport and requesting nobody fire at them as they approached. Actually seeing the vehicles, Anya quickly understood that new only applied as a manner of speaking. There were four of them, two sedans and two pickups. Proudly leading the way was a slab-sided old Citroën du CV with square headlights. Its gray color seemed to be what it normally was, not a product of the cloud-filtered afternoon light. Anya stood up from the pile of baggage where she'd been sitting. Levi remained seated beside her. He hadn't spoken a word since their earlier conversation, never took his nose out of the Hebrew paperback he'd pulled out of a pocket. She figured he was trying to give moral support in the face of her apparent shunning from the New York contingent by continuing to sit with her. Anya rebuffed efforts by Wolfork to strike up a conversation. She wasn't prepared to deal with his foibles, especially since he seemed to keep intruding deeper and deeper into her personal space. If he chose to interpret her unresponsiveness as shock reaction to taking human lives, or post-adrenaline slump, let him. The latter was at least partially true anyway. The unlikely procession pulled up alongside the baggage mounds, covered over with blue tarps against a restless wind that sent powdered snow scurrying and eddying everywhere. Baron himself drove the front car. Another man sat beside him. It wasn't Josh, whom Anya recognized, driving the Isuzu pickup next in line. Baron got out. Charlie lumbered over. Relief and concern washing over his big, slack features, like ripple echoes from two sides of a narrow pool.
Great! Found us more vehicles!
Yeah, but we got some news, too.
The Turkish army's really locking Ahri province down hard. We'll need to stick strictly to the back roads and camel trails from here on.
What about Peshmerga, dear boy?
As always, Wilfork had his small digital voice recorder out, waving it like a stubby magician's wand.
They seem to be of more immediate concern.
Maybe not. Allow me to introduce my man, Hamid.
A man unfolded himself from the other side of the gray Citroën. When he straightened, he was taller than Anya, at least as tall as Charlie, but lean and wolf-like, with coal-smudge eyebrows over dark, dangerous eyes. He had a thick mustache, but beard shadow covered the whole lower half of his face. The top edges of it, angling from ear to mouth, were so precisely straight it looked to have been stenciled on. Hamid wore a colorful wool-knit cap and a sheepskin jacket over weathered blue jeans. Behind her, Anya heard Trish Baxter. Hamid looked that way and scowled. Then he stepped forward and waved his hand.
No camera! No camera!
Jason and Tommy were both filming. With practiced ease, Jason stepped toward the tall newcomer, lowering his camera, while Tommy kept his up and recording.
Not a problem, my man.
The CHM crew chief's eyes cut to Baron.
Not a problem. We're not a news crew. We edit this before we send it back, and we can block out his face if that's what he wants.
Baron turned to Hamid.
Hamid?
Hamid stopped and lowered his hands, but he didn't stop glowering at the television crew.
This is Charles Bostitch, Levi Leibowitz, Robin Wilfork, Larry Tate, and Anya Creed.
Under other circumstances, Anya might have been mildly amused at the pecking order. Josh and the drivers of the other two vehicles came up, and introductions became more general. The local drivers might have been Kurds, too, but they were smaller and altogether less intimidating than Hamid. Anya waited until she noticed Baron standing momentarily apart from the others. She walked up to him.
Are you sure this is a good idea?
We lost our local guide and fixer, you may have noticed, under circumstances that maybe suggest we need one now more than ever. I know Hamid. I've worked with him before. He knows how to get things done.
Anya was prepared to swallow her ambivalence about Baron and his own ability to get things done, at least in the absence of firm evidence of actual wrongdoing. And as long as he seemed to be using his competence to keep everyone alive and moving forward. She wasn't happy about extending that kind of grace to a stranger in his native and dangerous land.
How well do you know him? It's not as if our relations with the local Kurds have been cordial so far.
Baron shrugged. He seemed impatient, shifting his weight from foot to foot and speaking with more than a hint of tension.
Look, I've worked with him, okay?
If anything, that set more alarm bells ringing. Anya knew they were not very far from the borders with Georgia and Armenia, two former Soviet republics affected by violent unrest, one of which recently fought and lost a short, if vicious, war with its former masters, not to mention how near they were to Iraq and Iran as well. It was not a tranquil part of the world. Nor did the possible kinds of work Hamid and Baron might have found to do together in the region allay Anya's many misgivings.
As I've told you before, there are Kurds and there are Kurds. Some of them shoot at us. Some are listed by the U.S. State Department as terrorist groups. Hamid here will help us deal with the bad ones. Look, why don't you just leave this part of things to the professional and not worry a pretty little head about it?
Did he really just say that?
Anya just stared at the arrogant man as he moved off with quick lizard motions across the snow to consult with some of the acolytes who were coming back from loading gear from the dead bus into one of the pickup trucks. It left her shaking her head.
Well, it troubles my scabby old outsized head, too, if it's any consolation to you, Ms. Creed.
Anya spun to find Robin Wilfork looming behind her.
So sorry. Didn't mean to startle you. I thought post-adrenaline reaction had set in and you'd be more relaxed.
Reaction had indeed set in, with its attendant mental dullness, sense of wondering what anything was worth, and incipient nausea. The after-effects of adrenaline overload were all too familiar to Anya.
Under the circumstances, relaxation doesn't seem to be much of an option, Mr. Wilfork.
Wilfork shook his imposing head. The wind ruffled his yellow-white hair as he gazed around the uneven horizon, with white-peaked mountain walls rising to the sides and in front. The breeze came from the west, though, and was warm. It wasn't snowing anymore.
I suppose not. I have to admit, dinosaur that I am, that under most circumstances, or I suppose if any other woman were involved, I'd quite agree with the bellicose Mr. Baron. But given the somewhat startling and indeed impressive faculties you've displayed, well, I'm just glad you're on watch as well. You may well see things our Masconigos blind the rest of us to.
He didn't say anything about Trish, the only other woman in the party. Anya tended to agree with the tacit assumption that Trish wouldn't be much use in danger. She wasn't at all abashed about that judgment either. It wasn't about being male or female, but about experience and courage. Abundantly blessed with physical courage, Anya tended not to be awed by it. She was more interested in the moral kind herself. That, to her mind, was what separated true heroes from the psychos and blunt instruments. From what she knew of Trish, she wasn't likely to rise up in the face of real danger. But she wasn't willing to let the journalist off the hook.
I would have thought old-school socialists had a more enlightened outlook on women, Mr. Wilfork.
Oh, my, no, my dear. Not as greybeards who were around when Marcuse and Che walked the earth. They were giants in those days. At least in their own minds. Nah, our prevailing wisdom was the dictum of Brother Stokely Carmichael, that the only place for women in the revolutionary movement is prone.
He ambled amiably off, suit coat hiked up and hands in his trouser pockets, leaving Anya with her eyebrows climbing up her forehead. Leif Baron said camel trails, and he meant camel trails. They came equipped with real camels.
Okay, are we officially having an adventure now?
Trish Baxter called from the back of her beast. Wedged between the furry humps, she swayed alarmingly in her saddle with each lurching step the camel took.
Well, if you're cold, miserable, uncertain where you're going to spend the night, hoping it doesn't snow again and your butt and the insides of your legs are chafing, that's definitely an adventure.
It was cold, although not currently snowing, and the winds weren't strong as the group threaded their way among hills where the steep rocky sides were dotted with bare scrub. Anya and her mount were cresting a low gravelly pass between ridges. Half of the long column had already passed over it. Anya wasn't at all miserable. Oddly enough, the transfer to the camel and mule train perked up the spirits of the whole Chasing History's monstrous crew. In fact, everybody's moods improved. It was as if the transition from machine power to muscle power signaled an entry into a fantasy realm. Anya held no illusions they were any safer than when they were clanking along in their collection of ramshackle vehicles, and she didn't know if any of the others actually harbored any. But she still shared the general high spirits. After 20 miles over washboard roads in their rattletrap convoy, the camels were a surprisingly pleasant change. They were also the only way around the Turk army.
So do these things, like, bite?
The travelers rode in front of the long line of baggage animals. Tommy had a video camera propped on one shoulder. With his other hand, he hung on for dear life to the high pommel of his camel saddle.
Yes, keep any fingers you want to keep away from their mouths.
But they're, like, so much fuzzier than real camels.
They are real camels, you dork!
No, I mean, like those ones in the old cigarette packs, like you always see in the old movies with Arabs in them. The ones with one hump.
Those are dromedaries. These are camels.
Oh, how much longer do we have to ride these ambulatory skeletons? Have pity on an old man's bones.
Not up to it, Wilfork.
Oh, cut him some slack, Leif. I feel the same way.
Anya had the strong impression he was aching to add the words, "and I need a drink."
We've got some distance to make yet. Just a little longer tonight, though.
Aren't we past the army patrols yet?
Nope.
Hey!
Larry Tate shoved his glasses, which had slipped down his nose, back into place and pointed. Looming up suddenly before them against the mauve evening sky was a block, almost a cube, huge and featureless, with a white or sand-colored wall tinged pink and orange with light thrown horizontally beneath the canopy of clouds by the near-setting sun.
What's that?
Hamid turned his camel and, swatting it lightly and deftly on the flanks with his whip, brought it trotting back along the line.
It is what they call here a khan.
It's a caravanserai.
What's that?
It's like a Holiday Inn for camel caravans.
Everyone, including Jason, looked at Tommy in surprise.
You don't mean to tell me you've ever actually cracked a history book.
I think I read it in an old X-Men comic.
One of the other men, stocky and middle-aged, rode out in the lead on a mule. He was already halfway down the slope toward a high and broad arched opening in the wall. As they got closer, Anya realized there were narrow windows around the upper stories. They looked like arrow slots, or rifle loops. Both Jason and Tommy carried their bulky video cameras balanced on their shoulders, with the rubber eyepiece guards pressed to their faces.
Loving this.
The arched door was actually a passage at least 20 feet long. As they rode through, Anya craned her neck to look up. In the gloom, she couldn't see anything but shadowed stone.
Looking for matterholes.
What are those, Mr. Wilfork?
Levi rode right behind Anya, clinging to his saddle with both hands.
They put them in the ceilings of the entrances to medieval European castles. They used to pour stuff like boiling oil on unwelcome visitors. And yes, Mr. Wilfork, I was looking for them.
Trish, who rode right in front of Anya, passed into the open courtyard inside the caravanserai. She twisted around in her saddle.
You guys are sick!
Not Levi. He was just asking a simple question.
Trish glared at Anya for a moment, then turned and rode away. They emerged into a wide courtyard. The tan ground was swept bare of snow and tamped hard. Around the courtyard, the lower floor was lined with stalls with broad but pointed arches, similar to the ones they entered through. A well of yellow stuccoed mud brick occupied the center of the large open square. Snow huddled in clumps against the south and west walls, dirty and with the glazed look that suggested it had partially melted and frozen over. Some of the stalls held animals. Some held men sitting cross-legged on carpets, smoking and arguing. Others stood empty. A gallery ran around the second floor. Beyond it were what looked like small rooms, or cells. Between the armed men walking along the gallery and at least a couple more on the flat roof, Anya got an impression of a prison more than of a hostelry. As the procession wound inside and around the central well, the animals came to a halt. They brayed greetings to the beasts in the stalls. The human guests eyed the newcomers with an interest Anya hoped was only curiosity.
Holy crap. We're not actually going to stay here.
No. You'll be at the Hilton over the next ridge where you cannot see. Paris Hilton herself, she will carry your bags.
But it's medieval!
It is Asia. Not the Asia of the Chinese infidels or Singapore with its shiny skyscrapers. The real Asia. We are poor here. Things go as they always have, with little change.
Anya couldn't help noticing that wasn't strictly true. She doubted, for example, that caravanserais in the heyday of the Silk Road boasted any appreciable number of bicycles. Nor did any of the guests in Tamerlane's time sport Kalashnikov rifles or auto pistols thrust through their sashes, much as they no doubt would have liked to. The caravan master had dismounted and gone to talk to several large men who stood not far from the entrance. Hamid joined them. Indicating to the others to hang loose, Charlie followed Hamid. Larry Tate trotted obediently behind. Stiffly, everyone else climbed off their mounts. Anya stretched. Her back made interesting noises, creaking and popping, but it felt wonderful. The other inmates of the caravanserai either ignored them or eyed them with frank interest.
These totally look like the dudes who hold Tony Stark hostage in the first Iron Man movie.
Hold that thought.
What kind of people do you think they really are?
Smugglers, drug runners, terrorists.
I don't know about you, but I intend not to go sticking my nose in their business and hope they'll extend us the same courtesy.
What? You're not going to do anything about it?
What would you like me to do? Call in an airstrike on my cell phone? Then where would we spend the night?
I thought you were the big law and order type.
Baron shook his head.
What you think of as law doesn't reach here and never has. Most likely never will, regardless of what you and I might prefer. But there's law here just the same.
The Old Testament patriarchs would feel right at home, and I think we'll find all the order we need.
You really think that?
What I know is that we're a long way from home, and it's probably not a good idea to go making enemies. This isn't New York City, and we are the foreigners. Satisfied, Junior?
Jason, Tommy, and Trish all moved closer to each other and looked unhappy, but they kept their opinions to themselves. The caravanserai turned out to be run by an indeterminate number of brothers, each one larger and more formidable than the last, and ruled over by an even bigger patriarch, who looked like Omar Sharif if Omar Sharif had turned into the Incredible Hulk, and whose white mustache was the largest Anya had ever seen on a human being. Then again, she wasn't sure she'd ever seen a larger human being to go with it. But even at that, he barely lived up to its magnificence.
Bismarck himself would go palsy with envy of that brush. I've only ever seen one greater, and that was on a Coelium terrier.
Out of the darkness, Hamid approached across the hard-packed courtyard.
The rules are simple.
Hamid gestured for the party to gather together near the well in the compound center.
The caravanserai is run by gypsies, but they are good Muslims. You want anything, you pay. You cause disturbance, they beat you with sticks and throw you out in the snow. You steal, they chop off your hand. You use a weapon or threaten one of them, they kill you. Then it's your body they throw out in the hills.
Why don't give you a proper Muslim burial?
They leave you for the wolves.
Wolves?
Larry Tate's eyes grew saucer-like behind his glasses. For once, his compulsive amiability seemed to have deserted him. It was such a startling transformation, Anya suspected their guide had touched a raw phobia.
Like, that's a big deal.
Trish held her hands in the pockets of her thick, down-filled jacket.
Wolves are never known to attack people.
Hamid fixed her with a baleful dark eye.
This may be true in the land of clean sheets in the MTV. Our strong Kurdish wolves have steel in their spines.
Despite the talk of wolves, after piling the gear and saddles in several stalls, the caravan master and a couple of his drovers led the unloaded camels and mules back out into the cold evening. Hamid explained there was an enclosure on the far side of the caravanserai from the one they'd come in through.
Aren't they worried about bandits?
Zeb shrugged.
Why? They're all inside with us.
Jeb finished his twin's thought.
It's all right out of the Arabian Nights. Except, of course, for the ridiculous techno-pop blasting over there. This may be Asia, the real Asia. But the modern age has made some inroads, looks like.
Hey, we got a whole wall to ourselves. Both floors.
There's benefits to traveling with a bazillionaire.
Trish stretched out on a genuine Bokhara carpet, rented from the gypsy proprietors, that covered the floor of one of the stalls. The trio shared it with Anya and the cheerful, myopic Rabbi Levi. Although the coolness they still showed Anya indicated it might be a temporary arrangement at best.
But how does he pay? I mean, I doubt the angry mustache gypsy brothers take traveler's checks, or will just, like, swipe his Visa Platonium card for him.
I wouldn't be too sure about that. I don't know if Charlie would use plastic, though. I don't think he wants to leave that kind of paper trail.
At any rate, we're probably better off not asking.
Jason gave her a puzzled frown. He seemed more pained than censorious, as if trying to understand her rather than condemn. But now things seemed to have changed.
I don't get you, Anya. I thought you were one of us. Then you go all Rambo on those guys at the roadblock. And you sure seem to want to play the good German where our right-wing fundamentalist pals are concerned.
The right-wing fundamentalist pals are paying for this expedition. Chasing History's Monsters is paying for you to tag along, and they've hired me as an expert.
Me too?
Levi didn't seem to be interested in the political subtexts here, far less the cultural ones. Neither impinged much on his personal solar system. But he seemed determined to show solidarity with Anya. Apparently, he considered her a friend. One way or another, his support comforted her.
Do you really think you should have taken the law into your own hands like that?
It looked to me as if it was me or nobody.
But you killed that man.
His friends had just shot down poor Mr. Atabeg in cold blood. His friends were trying their level best to kill Charlie, Leaf, and Larry. And he didn't look as if he'd boarded the bus to give us a language lesson in Kurdish. He had a gun, and he looked ready to use it. I saw my chance to stop him, so I did.
The CHM trio passed tight-lipped, furrowed-brow looks all around.
But you don't seem upset.
Why should I be? It's been hours since it happened. My heart rate's had plenty of time to settle.
I didn't mean that. I thought, shouldn't you be overcome by guilt for taking a human life?
Why should I feel guilty? I figured it was him, or one of you, or all of us. Why should I feel bad about the choice I made? I doubt he would have.
Cops always have bad dreams when they shoot somebody. They have to go through mad therapy.
Some of them do. And they're all taught to say they are. But I've talked to plenty who haven't really been traumatized or anything like it.
But why not?
Listen, I may have nightmares tonight about what happened today.
They looked relieved. She was starting to fit the profile again.
But I'll have nightmares about what could have happened if I didn't kill those men. If I'd missed. If they'd hurt or killed me or my friends. What they might have done to any survivors they captured.
She paused for a moment to let that sink in. She hoped they'd be able to understand the position she was in.
But as for feeling bad about stopping somebody intent on doing something bad, intent on committing murder, no, I don't feel remorse for that.
Trisha's eyes glittered with tears. She shook her head.
Oh, Anya, you seem like such a nice person. And now I'm afraid you might be some kind of sociopath or something.
If you'd feel more comfortable, I can go somewhere else. I'll find someplace else to room, too.
She and Trish had accepted Charlie's offer to share a chamber upstairs for the night.
No. I don't want to abandon you.
Don't want me to abandon you.
Anya realized that Trish feared the other occupants of the caravanserai, including, most likely, some of the young wolves.
It must be so weird and unhappy to live like that. To require so much violence to protect your lifestyle and to impose your views on others, yet to be so terrified of those who exerted violence on your behalf.
For all that she disagreed with them on just about every point philosophically, Anya had great respect for pacifists. But that was real pacifists, not those who smugly felt themselves morally superior while relying on men with uniforms and guns to do their dirty work for them. Still, she admitted to herself, we're not here to agree with each other, nor to serve my bruised ego. She forced herself to smile and turned to Trish.
That's very good of you. Look, I appreciate your concern, and I just have to ask you, please, to accept that we're different people with some different outlooks.
Trish pressed her lips together. Anya guessed that for her part she was biting back on saying how glad she was that they were different.
Okay, I...
A figure loomed out of the courtyard darkness. Everybody tensed for a moment. Seeing it was Baron caused incomplete relaxation.
Chow's on! Better hustle your butts if you want to eat!
What is it? Meals refused by Ethiopians?
Got it in one.
Why use up our own supplies?
They might need their MREs to fuel them once they started their mountain climbing expedition.
I thought they sold food here.
We put our heads together and decided we didn't have a high trust level in what the gypsy bros have on offer.
So they're typical capitalists, selling tainted food to their customers.
More like the kind of food their usual patrons can afford and are happy to eat. Wouldn't settle too easily in tender Western tummies, too many rat and insect parts per million. To these people, it's all just protein.
There was an Indian mathematician who moved to Britain in the early 20th century. He starved to death because the British rice was lacking in just those proteins, the bug and rat ones. Too clean, you see. Not like Mama served back in Bombay.
I think you're talking about Ramanujan. Actually, he didn't starve to death, exactly, but he did suffer a severe protein deficiency that probably contributed to his death at the age of 32.
I think he and his area of expertise was somewhat different from yours.
It's a nerd thing.
Tommy got to his feet.
Hey, I'm a committed carnivore. I'm not gonna lie to you. So why make a big deal out of it?
Yeah, I guess I trust the mystery meat and MREs over the rat bits.
Always assuming the meals ready to eat aren't made of rat parts themselves, you poor naive creature.
Hey, at least they're sterile rat parts.
They walked off following Baron to dinner like schoolchildren. Wilfork gestured with the travel fork he'd taken from a pocket and unfolded.
A moment of your time, if you please, Anya.
What is it?
That Baron's an interesting man.
Wilfork pointed after the furloughed security company executive with his hobo tool.
With the emphasis on man. Charlie's still an overgrown schoolboy, as am I for that matter. Levi's a scholar, which is another thing altogether, and our muscular Christians, well, they may be of the age of majority, but they remain a core boys with a happy feral fury of adolescence.
After a moment's silence, broken only by the tinkle of bells as a camel was led out through the eastern door, Anya stretched her neck a bit and turned to Wilfork.
So you were going to warn me about Baron?
Perceptive and tenacious. You're a formidable woman, Miss Creed. Yes, indeed I was. Perhaps I'm wasting my breath.
I appreciate the thought. I respect Baron. He seems to be good at his job. He's certainly the only thing that's got us this far. He may have kept us all alive.
With a little help from me, Anya thought. But she was just as happy that part wasn't widely known.
Otherwise, I wouldn't associate with him if you were the last man on Earth.
Well, that's certainly decisive. Let us hope you never have cause to regret it.
It's always a risk, isn't it, Mr. Wilfork? But isn't life risky?
An excellent point, my dear. No one here gets out alive, as the poet said.